to the afternoon session of the State Court of Appeals for today. My name is Ann Gardner, and to my right is Justice Bob McCoy. To my left is Justice Lee Gabriel. We're your panel for this afternoon. I'm not going to call each name. I'm not going to ask our deputy clerk to either. I'm going to call it as Eastern Express et al. Versus XTO et al. Are the parties and attorneys ready?
Appellants are here and ready now. I believe they're here.
Okay, very good. Mr. Donheiser, would you like to proceed, and we'll just go ahead and get started.
Thank you, Your Honor.
As I said, my name is Mark Donheiser, and I represent all of the appellants in the three combined cases. As the court has read the briefs, you know there are many, many issues and sub-issues, and if I were to equally divide my time, I'd be spending about 30 seconds on each. So I'm going to have to leave some of it to the briefing, probably numerically half the issues at least. The court may or may not be aware, however, that there are two similar cases winding their way up here with different homeowners associations against different gas companies that have a lot in common. And so I specifically want to address in some detail the applicability of the statute of frauds, because although these cases are all different, that's going to be an issue that is common to all three of those cases. The deal reached here between the Southeast Arlington Coalition of Texas and XTO is fairly straightforward. CTEX is an unincorporated association that was formed for purposes of negotiating for the neighborhood area gas leases with different companies, offering the company that met its standards its endorsement and assistance in gathering the neighborhoods, marshaling the area on their behalf. The Barnett Shale presented unique issues for the gas companies, having to lease properties, obtain leases in urban areas where there could be four or five or more separate owners on a single acre. Groups like CTEX and the others, some panel of this court will be hearing about in a few months, were a godsend. They enabled the gas companies to get large areas under control for their exclusive benefit without having to send land men to door to door as they had been doing. And XTO admits this. Once the deal was reached, CTEX endorsed XTO as the gas lease company of choice for the neighborhood.
The word endorsed is just not a legal term that I'm familiar with in the context of legal terminology for contracts. Could you expand on that a little bit?
I'm not using it in any specific legal sense. I'm using it in the common, ordinary English sense of we say this is the person to go with. This is the company to go with. It is like Michael Jordan and Nike, Your Honor.
That's what I was going to say. That's what you're saying.
That is what I am saying. That is what they wanted. They wanted, what XTO wanted, was to be able to get this endorsement from this group so that people like my clients would not sign with other companies, but would sign with the preferable lease that XTO had negotiated with CTEX.
But the people like your clients were not obligated to do so.
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
That's bothering me.
No, Your Honor, absolutely not. They weren't. That was made absolutely clear at the very beginning of the negotiation that XTO Mr. Young asked that question, and the response was no. We are not obligating any individual. It is up to them to make the decision. What we are doing is endorsing you as the gas company of choice to our area, and if they want to, they can do it. Just like you don't have to, just because Michael Jordan says they're the best, you don't have to buy Nike tennis shoes. And CTEX, consideration of this, XTO agreed to the terms they would offer, the royalty, the signing bonus, etc., and the actual form of lease, which is in the record, the lease they agreed to offer to these people.
And that's the writing that you're relying on, correct? I mean, you say that they agreed to enter into a writing. There's not a writing which reflects your agreement with XTO, correct?
My client's agreement? No, Your Honor, there is not.
And there wasn't even a you didn't anticipate entering into a writing that reflects your agreement with XTO.
My clients?
No, your group.
Okay, I do not represent CTEX, Your Honor. I represent individuals. No, they did not enter into a specific writing. No.
So what was the term of that agreement?
The term? The length?
The length between CTEX and XTO. How long was this supposed to go on for?
Until they had offered the agreed upon lease to each person within the area who wished to sign one. That was the agreement they reached.
And where is that reflected?
It's reflected in a series of email exchanges between XTO and Linda Rosano and others who were the negotiating committee of CTEX. If you look at page 591, beginning on page 591 of the clerk's record in the Miles case, you'll find her affidavit, which outlines exactly the sequence of negotiations until they reach the deal, and it references the exhibits attached, the various emails that made up that agreement. That's actually afterwards. What you're asking about is the formation of the agreement between CTEX and XTO. And that is a series of emails, and Ms. Rosano goes through it in detail, what the negotiations were, what the agreements are, and you have the lease form that was agreed that has the specific terms that were agreed to be offered to the mineral estate owners. So the question is whether that agreement will give you the endorsement and help you marshal the neighborhoods in exchange for you offering those terms to the people within our geographic area needs to meet the statute of frauds. When construing and applying a statute, the first place to look is the wording of the statute itself. The statute of frauds, as it applies here, states that it applies to, and I'm quoting, a contract for the sale of real estate. Remember, we're not talking about, my clients aren't suing on their individual contract with XTO. They're suing as third-party beneficiaries, intended third-party beneficiaries, of the agreement between CTEX and XTO. The agreement between CTEX and XTO is not a contract for the sale of real estate. CTEX had no mineral interests or other real estate for that matter. It wasn't selling that. It was selling its endorsement and its power in the neighborhood to marshal the landowners.
Wasn't it acting as a disclosed agent for the landowners in doing this stuff?
No, Your Honor. They had no authority to bind these people to anything.
Okay.
They were acting, basically, you read Ms. Brizzano's affidavit, the neighborhoods had been flooded with landmen. People were confused as to what was going on, why they were getting these. A lot of the neighborhoods that make up CTEX are in homeowners associations where there are deed restrictions prohibiting this sort of thing. The questions arose, this homeowners associations, neighborhood associations began to talk to each other, and this entity grew up and began to negotiate for with the gas companies, not just XTO, but others submitted bids for their endorsement, not for their mineral rights, not for their real property, but for their endorsement and their assistance, because this was such a nightmare for everyone, the landowners and the gas companies. This contract, this agreement, and I've cited in my brief the multiple times XTO representatives and its agents refer to this as the CTEX deal. They're not saying we didn't reach some sort of understanding. They're just saying it's not enforceable. This deal does not involve the transfer of real property. CTEX had none. It was not purporting to have any. No real property interest, equitable, legal, or otherwise, was changing hands. And that's what the statute of frauds, if you read the literal wording that the legislature chose, involves. The legislature could have said any contract in any way involving, relating to, concerning the present or future transfer of an interest in real property. They didn't. They didn't use those words. The recent Supreme Court case of Ganim v. Alitar is a great example, and I've sent the court the site in a letter last week with a copy of the slip opinion, in which the highlights this nicely. In Ganim, the claimant alleged that he had reached an agreement with Alitar to jointly purchase a piece of property and to hold it jointly. Jury found that there was such an agreement, and damages were awarded, and the Court of Appeals reversed, saying no, that needs to satisfy the statute of frauds, and it doesn't, because it concerns real estate. Supreme Court said no, it doesn't. They reversed. They said an agreement between two parties to jointly purchase is not a contract for the sale of real estate. And they don't go into great depth, but they cite three 19th century Supreme Court decisions which do go into more depth, and they say exactly what I'm saying. A contract for the sale of real estate is one which, if effectuated, transfers some interest, some title, legal or equitable, in the real property. If it doesn't do that, it's not a contract for the sale of real estate. The cases that XTO relied upon below, and apparently continues to rely upon now, all involve a contract in which some interest in real property, equitable or legal, is going to be transferred if the contract is enforced. They rely upon an option case, where an option to purchase. Well, an option, as the court noted in that case, is an equitable interest in real property. It transfers something tangible. And there's good reason for this. What is the purpose of the statute of frauds? The general, if you read the cases they talk about, it's to prevent fraud and perjury. But that would apply to any contract, and we don't require every contract to be in writing. Why these eight that the legislature chose in the statute of frauds, these eight types of contracts, are covered? Why they have to be in writing and everything else doesn't? why have this restriction on the free right to contract? And the reason, I'm not going to address the other seven because they're irrelevant. The reason for this one is because we have an elaborate system of recordation of title and interests in real property. We don't want anything floating out there, unrecorded, that may interfere with that. The CTEX XTO contract does no such thing. It does not interfere because anyone, another gas company coming to Mrs. Miles or to Eastern Express, can freely buy, lease their mineral estate interest. And the fact that there's a contract between CTEX and XTO for this endorsement has no effect on that. It happened all the time. Lots of people did it. Didn't go with XTO. Now, 4,000 of them did before XTO breached, giving them over 1,000 acres in southeast Arlington before they simply breached. I see I'm out of time.
May it please the court, Mr. Donhauser. As Justice Higginbotham said from the Fifth Circuit, every contract requires a meeting of minds, and not every meeting of the minds is a contract. I'd like to discuss two main issues with you today. First, before we get to the statute of frauds, we have to think about whether this was in fact an enforceable contract. All that happened here was an understanding between CTEX and XTO that was an agreement to agree. It required essential terms to be negotiated in the future, and is therefore was not enforceable. Moreover, the very thing that they have asked the trial court and this court to enforce, a term of a irrevocable offer, to offer every member of CTEX the terms that were negotiated, is not contained anywhere in the record. There's not one email, not one document that would support that. Secondly, I'd like to discuss whether this understanding is in fact falls under the statute of frauds, as it clearly does, and the fact that statute of frauds was not, the elements of such was not met. To have an enforceable contract, there has to be a meeting of minds as to all enforceable or material terms. As this court stated, an agreement to make a future contract is enforceable only if it is specific as to all essential terms, and no terms of the proposed agreement may be left to future negotiations. And then further, the Engelman Court, 960 Southwest 2nd at 343, they state, as a general matter, Texas courts have consistently held that a contract may be held void for indefiniteness if it fails to specify the time of performance, the price to be paid, the work to be done, the service to be rendered, or the property to be transferred. Well, this understanding between CTEX and XTO, an opposing counsel keeps calling a contract, were all essential material terms agreed to, and are those terms represented in the record? The answer is no, they weren't agreed to, and no, they aren't in the record. First of all, we don't know who the landowners are that we're supposed to buy minerals from. There's nothing in the record that would indicate that. They had a loose, rough map at one point in time, early in negotiations. That was struck from the record, and they don't appeal that evidentiary objection. Secondly, even after this negotiated form lease was done, they still kept adding people, or they were trying to add people to who CTEX is. Presumably, they could keep adding people all the way out to El Paso. Do we have an obligation to add, to offer our negotiated lease to people out in El Paso, even though the market doesn't support the terms? Of course not. And lastly, and also, with regard to this negotiated lease form, every term of that could be held for future negotiations. The lease agreement itself says that. And CTEX wanted that language in the lease because they didn't want to have any repercussion from the landowners. They didn't want the landowners coming back and suing them for doing a bad job as their agent. So in the actual lease forms, it says that the homeowners were not obligated to sign with XTO, that they had the right to negotiate completely different terms with XTO, and, quote, it was ultimately responsibility of the lessor to the homeowners to determine if lessor wants to negotiate the leases, that it's their responsibility to fully investigate the issues and facts related to signing an oil and gas lease, and determine what terms are acceptable to them to be included in the lease.
Yeah,
That is the form lease that was attached to emails in the record. I can get the record site for you. It was attached to the Rosano affidavit. So that, and that's what they're trying to get us to enter into with all these other landowners that didn't sign up. So it's clear that this understanding didn't have essential terms that were met. And the way that I equate this to, and I think a perfect example of it, is if I had a real estate agent trying to sell a house. And a buyer comes in, and the real estate agent says, I'll tell you what, if you meet these particular terms, I will recommend to my homeowner that they accept your offer. And at the time, the market supports it, and the buyer says, okay, I'll meet those. And so a month later, before any of the documents are drafted, before the actual homeowner himself decides whether he's going to sell it or not, the market crashes, and it's not worth that. And the buyer says, well, the market's different. I don't think I want to go through with that. And then the real estate agent says, well, wait a minute. We had an agreement. We agreed that I would tell my client to enter into this agreement. If you would do, it's this two-tiered agreement they keep talking about. It just makes no sense, especially in that context.
Well, I may be misinterpreting their argument, but it seems to me that the landowners are arguing an analogy to a group insurance, group health insurance agreement with an employer of various employees who could be unidentified or changed, you know, over time, but that they would have the option to enter into the agreement. Could you elaborate on that?
Yes, Your Honor. That example is completely inapplicable because first you have an extensively written insurance contract that expressly says the term of the contract and expressly says exactly what new employees can come in and can get on the plan, and it says exactly how they have to do it. It says exactly what paperwork they have to fill out, and it says you're going to cover them until X day. And that's what the insurance contract says. Here, we don't have a written contract with CTEX. We don't have anything in the record that says we'll hold these terms open till X period of time. And so it's completely inapplicable. It's apples and oranges for those reasons. And getting down to what is in the record, notwithstanding the fact that we have all these essential terms that weren't met, we don't have a basic meeting of the minds on what I call an irrevocable option agreement. What they're trying to do is get XTO to hold themselves out to this particular form lease with these terms for eternity, apparently. And we weren't compensated for that, one. And two, there's nothing in the record that would support that. An irrevocable option agreement has to be supported by independent consideration to be enforceable. And opposing counsel himself has admitted that, well, when those emails were sent, that was much later. Well, that's true. It was much later after they completely did whatever they were going to do. And it was just a gratuitous statement. Well, first of all, let's look at those emails. First of all, the trial judge, Judge Cosby, has struck those from the record based on summary judgment objections. They haven't appealed any summary judgment objection. So those are outside the record to begin with. There's nothing in the record in this case that would support it, that there was any term discussion. Secondly, like I said, those gratuitous statements that, oh, you know, we'll sign everybody up with, quote, a lease, that was done after everything they said they would do, they did. There was no additional consideration. It was completely gratuitous. There's nothing to support enforcing that statement. And I think more basically, if the court does look at that document, which is outside the record, that statement is so vague and meaningless as to not be, it doesn't support an irrevocable option agreement. It doesn't say, we will provide these specific terms to anybody who claims to be a CTEX member forever, no matter what the market does. It doesn't say that at all. It just says a lease. Well, in October, after October 15th, we were still offering leases, but just at market rates. And, of course, that's not what they want. They don't want market rates. They want the rate at the height of the market. There's nothing in the record that would support a meeting of the minds on the very issue they're suing on, and would ask this court to affirm the summary judgment on that point. But even if we look at, okay, there is some understanding, and let's just say hypothetically it's enforceable, to be enforceable it has to meet the statute of frauds. To meet the statute of frauds, an agreement to convey an interest in real property must be in writing, it must be signed by the party charged with enforcement, and it must contain a legal description. Any conveyance of a mineral interest is a conveyance of real property. And we have cases over cases in our brief that say conveying mineral interest applies to the statute of frauds. Well, we'll take hypothetically that there was some sort of an understanding there. what they're trying to enforce is XTO promising to buy real property interests. That's the only relief they seek is specific informants, is getting us to enter into these lease agreements, to give them the bonus and give them the royalty terms. That's the only thing they seek. The only promise they're trying to hold us to, if you will, is a promise to enter into these conveyances. And so there's multiple cases, for example, the Noxum versus Cockburn case. That dealt with a landowner, an oil and gas producer. Oil and gas producer promised to buy his mineral estate. And in exchange, the landowner let the oil and gas company come on, drill a well, build a sludge pit on his property, dry hole. Oil and gas company says, we changed our mind. We don't want to buy your minerals. Landowner sues him and says, well, you promised you would. The Court of Appeals said, King's Act statute of fraud applies to that promise to, in the future, purchase a mineral interest. The exact same thing we're talking about here. They're saying, we promise to, in the future, buy mineral interest. That is the same thing that applies, the statute of fraud would apply to that, as same as an actual transaction for a conveyance of mineral interest. They cite to the Gannon versus Farouk case, which Supreme Court case, it's just completely opposite the facts of this case here. There was an actual transaction. Someone bought real estate. The issue was who owned the real estate after the transaction was done. And there were two people that said, we bought it jointly, and I own it, and you own it together in a partnership. The Supreme Court said, that doesn't apply to the statute of frauds, this issue of whether joint ownership of a transaction. Here, and applied to this case, it would be as if XTO and some other unnamed gas company agreed to buy oil and gas interests jointly. And then we did that. We bought oil and gas interests. And then XTO told the other gas company, we changed our minds, we're going to own them all by ourselves. In that case, the other oil and gas company wouldn't have statute of frauds issue. But there's already been a transaction. Here, the Supreme Court cited White versus McNeil, an earlier opinion, and agreed with the result, but distinguished it. The White versus McNeil case dealt with a partnership, where the partner promised to transfer his mineral interests into the partnership in exchange for, you know, capitalizing the partnership and being a part of it. Then he changed his mind, decided he didn't want to be a part of the partnership, I'm not going to transfer my oil and gas interests. But the other partner sues him, and the court says, statute of fraud applies, you can't enforce this promise to convey a mineral interest. And Supreme Court supported that. This case is much more similar to the White versus McNeil case than the facts in Gannon. Here, there is no writing, as the court has alluded to, that would support either the CTEX agreement, and certainly no writing that would support an agreement with the landowners. Now, there's no signature, there's no property descriptions in the record that would support any kind of living up to the requirements of the statute of frauds. Specifically, this court in Sun Key Oil versus Wheely voided a mineral deed because the property description was inadequate and that it described an unidentified portion of a larger tract. Tried to convey mineral interest and said, well, we'll convey a portion of this larger tract. And the court said, no, that's not specific. We don't know what portion. Well, the very best argument they have is the property description is it's all of CTEX. We don't know what all of CTEX ever was. It was always changing. But even so, they admit that undisputed evidence in the record was 40% of some of these areas were already leased up. So we don't know what part of CTEX would be leased, what part wouldn't, what's the property description. We have no idea. And so for that reason, it violates the statute of frauds. Your Honors, to get around the statute of frauds, they've pleaded two exceptions, the performance exception and the estoppel exception. First of all, the performance exception requires that there be strong evidence of an agreement and its terms. It requires that the plaintiff acted in reliance on that agreement, that the plaintiff has suffered some substantial detriment, and that the defendant would reap an unearned benefit. They have to plead and prove, or at least present a question of fact on each of those elements to be able to get around the statute of frauds. First of all, there's no evidence, much less strong evidence, of an agreement and its terms. There's no evidence of an irrevocable option agreement. There's no evidence of any reliance. Basically, their reliance argument is an act of omission. We didn't enter into other leases, but there's no evidence that other leases were ever offered. And their omission isn't necessarily referable to our alleged promise. They have no detriment, and they certainly XTO has reaped no benefit from not entering into leases with them. Estoppel doesn't apply because there's no agreement in writing that we promised to sign. And that is a requirement under Moorburger. That is the facts of Moorburger. And the courts, we've briefed them in our brief, clearly support that. But also for the same reason, there's no evidence of reliance or detriment, which is also required for estoppel. And even if you get by those two issues, what does performance and reliance get you? It only gets you in equity, the place you were before this alleged reliance. It gets you reliance damages, out-of-pocket expenses. If I've done something as a plaintiff out-of-pocket and reliance on a promise, then I get that back. I don't get my expectancy.
What about forbearance? Could you address forbearance from entering into other leases?
Well, first of all, there's no evidence that they did that. There's no evidence that there were any other offers on the table to them in the record. And so there's no evidence that they did forbear. There's only evidence is that they just didn't sign a lease. But they didn't sign a lease for the past 100 years. They still had their minerals. So the fact that they continued to not sell their lease, I don't think is any evidence to support reliance. Finally, in conclusion, Your Honors, just because CTEX and XTO had an understanding as to certain lease terms at one point in time doesn't mean that the individual landowners can enforce XTO to, may I briefly conclude, can force XTO to offer the same terms perpetually into the future without any written document supported with consideration that's specific to require it to do that. We ask this court to affirm the trial court's correct judgment dismissing their claims. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Donheiser, would you like to offer rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
Briefly, one of the last statements, no evidence of other offers or that they were turned down. The Miles clerk's record at 937 has Mr. Chow of Eastern Express specifically stating that he had an offer in his hand for a higher signing bonus than XTO was offering, and he turned it down on reliance on XTO's promise. Also look at the Miles clerk's record at 924, where Mrs. Miles talks about her reliance. Another record issue that I'd like to correct is this assertion that we're citing to exhibits that were stricken by the trial judge, and we did not appeal. We have appealed some of the parole evidence rulings, but except when they are acknowledged as parole evidence rulings that we are have appealed, we cited only to exhibits and only to portions of Ms. Rosano's affidavit that were not stricken. It is XTO's counsel's problem that they submitted multiple versions of the same exhibit and only objected to some of them. That you have an email train, they object to an email, an exhibit 10 in advance, but that is repeated later on. It's in the record, it's not objected to, it's before this court for all purposes. We were very careful not to do what we've been accused of doing. They haven't checked to see which ones were objected to and which ones were not. The first part of the argument were essential terms still to be negotiated, and they didn't give you a single term left to be negotiated between CTEX and XTO. Not a single one. What they're talking about is the ultimate deal that they reached with 4,000 landowners and that they were supposed to reach with my clients. That's a different contract. We're suing on as third-party beneficiaries, intended third-party beneficiaries, of the agreement between CTEX and XTO. And there's no question that CTEX was negotiating for my clients. That's what they told XTO. It's all over the record. It's even reflected in that agreed lease form that CTEX and XTO agree. It says CTEX is doing this on behalf of the people within these neighborhoods. They were asked what neighborhoods they were. It's in, again, the Miles clerk's record at page 599, where Ms. Rosano tells them what neighborhoods. There may be some disputes in other cases about whether certain neighborhoods got in, but not as to my clients.
What about the bonus amount? Was there an agreement as
absolutely.
To the amount?
Absolutely, Your Honor. All of that, the bonus, the royalty, all of those were agreed to, and it's reflected clearly in the record. Thank you.
Thank you. And thanks to all counsel. Very good briefing, good arguments. Your case is submitted, and you're excused.